It's what? It's August 31st, 2016. I'm Xavier Schley. I'm here with Mike Harned. I'm going to say something here. Your voice?
It's Mike Harned, and I'm here with Schley.
All right. So I was thinking maybe I would talk a little bit about how this got started and how your name got into it right at the beginning. And then we'll just kind of do a little interview of how you got in the business. So I was talking to Kim about this. When we were at the technology and membership mixer in Kenai, someone brought up doing a podcast, and I couldn't even remember who, but the minute it got brought up, it was just a unanimous, yes, we want to do that, you know? And it wasn't but a few minutes after that that somebody said your name, and everybody in the room went, oh, yeah, that's the guy for it, because you know everybody, you got a great voice for it, you know? But it's interesting that none of us can remember exactly who brought that up. It was just, it instantly became, that's we should do that. You know, I think I called you right after that. So the idea behind this kind of is, or the initial idea was that we'd go out to some people, especially people that you know in our industry that have seen our state change. Because I got to thinking about it, like, I don't think that you could be in a state that's changed more within the last, say, 50 years, you know, and so our industry specifically has a generation of people that saw this state change pretty dramatically and was instrumental to that change. So I like the idea of going out to those people and talking to them about it. So that was kind of the impetus of this. And then, you know, I thought we'd do a little mock-up of it just to show kind of what we're thinking. And so for these other guys, I kind of was, what I'm interested in is, A, what was the construction industry like back then? How did they get involved in it? How did they get to Alaska? How has it changed, you know? So how long, you retired what?
And I retired in 8 years, eight you know and a half years ago.
I know exactly when you retired because it's the reason I have the job I have. You retired in 2008, and Dave got your job and was looking for somebody to hire, and then he hired me, and I started in 2008. It. So yep. Did you retire in 2007 or 2008?
No, 2008. It was actually April 1st, 2008.
Yeah, and I started in May. Yeah.
But I got into the business I had done other construction jobs. I'd worked up on the oil fields and up on the North Slope and out in the Cook Inlet. Worked the year after the earthquake, I worked over in Kodiak, was there putting in new water lines. I was still in high school then and doing it. But we've done, you know, my whole life has been around construction or construction supply.
Were you born here? Or?
No, my dad was in the military, and we moved to Alaska in 1961, and we moved to Juneau. And then he retired from the Coast Guard and moved to Anchorage in 1963.
Why did he choose Anchorage?
Well, he was hired as the port director for the city of Anchorage. Okay. And so he was running the port. During the earthquake.
You got here before it.
We were here before the earthquake.
How you said you came in 63. That was right. The quake was 64. Okay. Yep.
And he was, talking about other things, but he was instrumental in getting Sealand to come in to Alaska for the first time, which was right after the earthquake. He and the port commission put together a deal, and before then, Whittier and Seward had been the two major ports for bringing freight in. Mm-hmm. And then after the earthquake, because they were destroyed, that all of a sudden Anchorage was the port.
Oh, no
and
kidding.
By bringing in more things, especially on Sealand and different types of ships and faster service, all of a sudden Anchorage was, you know, had to rebuild the whole state basically through Anchorage during the earthquake.
Now, was the port in Anchorage just not as hard hit as those other places, or was it just not as developed anyway? So it,
well, two things. It wasn't as developed. It didn't even hardly have any cranes. It surely didn't have any big cranes on the thing for doing containers. I mean, they had regular cranes just to lift stuff off barges, but there was no container ships coming in at that time, and there wasn't any damage. I mean, major damage to the dock here.
How old were you in?
I was 14.
So you remember it. What were you doing?
Yeah. Well, I just got back from Alyeska from skiing. I was sitting on.
What was Alyeska like in 64?
They just had one.
Just chair one.
One chair one.
Yeah.
And we got back from skiing, and I was sitting on the side of the bed, and I remember that Scotty Ferguson was on the radio and he said, man, we're having a little bit of an earthquake. And then it really started and I got up and tried to walk into, my dad was homesick and he was laying in bed. So I walked in there because, you know, I was a little worried about what was going on. And so we were standing there looking out the window and the trees were going back and forth like windshield wipers. And my mom was sitting in the driveway.
What part of town were you in then?
We lived in Turnigan.
Okay.
And so, my mom was halfway in the car and halfway out, and she was pretty good size, and she was just kind of flopping around like a rag doll, and she was watching the garage door go up and down, so it was kind of like a blind, just yeah. going back and forth. You could see the ground crack out in front of us. I mean, they're not big cracks, but, I mean, 6-inch cracks, and about that time, the whole end of our house went out, and then because we had a masonry fireplace, and it just collapsed and took the whole end of the house out.
Were you in the part of Turnigan that sunk and moved?
We were, well, I tell everybody I was 4 blocks from the bluff when the earthquake started and 2 blocks afterwards.
And wow.
We were, when the earthquake ended, we, you know, we had some damage in the house and we thought, boy, that was something.
But it was a long earthquake.
A little over 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And really didn't think of anything else until people came running past telling us that the bluff had collapsed. And so I went down with my Polaroid camera, and I think I have 10 shots, which was what was on a roll of film, of all the same thing. It just all this stuff piled up on top of each other,
yeah.
You know, and came back and told my dad what was going on, and he kind of, you know, we were trying to find my little brother, couldn't find him, but
oh, that must have been scary.
Then he went, when eventually we tracked him down, but he went down, we tried to get through town during the middle of the night to see if he even had a job left, see what was there.
See if the port was even still around. Yeah.
Yeah, and the 4th Avenue was completely collapsed, and so we didn't make it downtown, or past downtown. And so about, I'd say it was probably around 10 o'clock at night, the cops came and got him to take him down, and they were having a meeting, the mayor and everybody in the civil service, and, you know, people were trying to figure out what had happened, what they could do, and, you know, where they were, and start putting things together. And he pretty much worked all night my timeline may be a little off. It might have been the next day, because the first night we got evacuated because they thought there was a tidal wave coming.
So we left
our house and went up to another place. And so I think first thing in the morning they came and got him.
Where did you go? I mean,
well, actually we just went farther into Turnigan. They said that was far enough back, and we spent the night in the house with about 8 other families, and there's friends of my parents, and I was the oldest kid, so I had to babysit all the kids, and all the parents got smashed. I mean, they were just having an earthquake party at that time, but that's kind of the way it was. And then after the earthquake, it was, you know, all the rebuilding and everything that went there. And the week after, we were actually, I was a Boy Scout, so we were down salvaging stuff out of people's houses.
Yeah.
And so the Army was down there, and we had, you know, trucks and loaders and things like that trying to make roads down to where some of these houses were to get their stuff out. And all of Turnigan was pretty much, well, they said martial law, but they had, you had gates to get in and out, and they had the National Guard guys stationed around, and we had the big water tanks, so we had water, and so we had to haul water for quite a while. And
they had martial law. Was it necessary, like nowadays when there's a hurricane or there's a big earthquake, you know, there tends to be looting and stuff. Did that happen back then?
I don't remember hearing of any looting.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean there wasn't any, but I didn't hear of it. And it was, but they were there for that reason, to protect the houses that had gone over, because everything was in them.
You know, yeah.
But then after that, that was a year after that summer. I worked over in Kodiak. We were drinking water lines. I was over there pretty much all summer, and we really didn't get anything done because we couldn't get permits.
so that hasn't changed much.
hadn't changed. That's one thing that stayed the same.
Were you just out of high school then, or
I was still in high school?
Okay, you went and worked in Kodiak, like as
I was 15 years old.
Sophomore or something, junior.
I, actually, I was still 14 years old. Wow. And I was working for, it was a friend of my dad's.
Yeah.
And so I went over there, and I don't know what they could have, I mean, but I don't think they had the laws that they have now, but I could have gone over
for
there.
For child labor. Yeah.
But I was over there, and really, I mean, we dug some water lines, and that was about it. But then came back, and then after I got out of high school, I went to college for a little bit. But
where did you go?
I went to, well, Eastern Oregon College, and then I went to UA here, or Community College. That was it. And then started working out in the oil fields. Worked out on either, there were some floating barges that were drilling, and then also worked on a couple of the different platforms. And then I worked for an oil company here in town as a kind of office boy, working with the land guy that was buying the land. And was working for them during the big auction when they auctioned off all the property up on the North Slope.
Oh, really?
So that was, you know, it was a little, almost $1 billion worth of bidding that went on at that time.
And can I ask you a question? Like, when you were that age and you were looking for a job in construction or whatever, was there a problem finding a job, or if you wanted one and were willing to work, the place was small enough that you could get one?
There was jobs available, and if you looked real hard, you could do it. But I was real, real lucky. This is my best friend's dad was drilling supervisor for one of the oil companies, and so that's how I got on with the oil platforms and working up on the North Slope and with the oil companies. So I kind of had an in with somebody. But it was funny, after I came back from college, and I came back in the early I took two semesters and then came back and skipped the third one because I was looking for a job, and he had already kind of slowed down in the oil field, so I knew I didn't have anything going there. So I was looking. I pounded on doors and trying to find a job, and it's kind of one of those things, who you know and how you knew him. But my dad was at a Rotary meeting with sitting next to Bob Park, who is the vice president and general manager of Anchored Sand. And my dad said, well, how's business? He says, man, we are so swamped, we can't even find people to work. And he said, man, have I got a kid for you. And so I went down and talked to the labor foreman. He told me I could have a job. I had to get in the union, but I needed to get a haircut and shave, and he didn't want any hippies working for him.
Wait, what year did you say it was?
This was the 1970.
Okay.
And so no long hair, no beards, no mustaches or anything like that. Every couple of weeks, he'd give you some time off to go get a haircut. And that's about it. But I worked at Anchored Sand as a laborer for about 5 years. Started stacking blocks in the block plant. The machines that they have now are completely different. I mean, they have automatic cubers where you just basically push a button. But in that days, it was all manual.
Yeah.
You literally stacked every block. There was a clamp that you could put some blocks down onto the pallet, and then there was one guy running the clamp and two guys stacking blocks. And so that's how every block was handled coming out of that block plant.
Now, where was Anchor Sand and Gravel then?
We were on First Avenue at that point.
Where on First?
It was 1813 East First was the office number, but it's kind of where was it Linden's office is now. And there's if you go down on First Avenue and Linden's office, and there's a bunch of other people, but that was our whole complex. I mean, there was a big gravel pit behind us.
That was a gravel pit down there one time, huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
Actually, they mined out of it. And after Herb, there was some apartments up on the hill right on off of Commercial Drive, and they mined, and they tore the apartments down and mined that out.
Oh, Anchored
Sand did. Somebody else actually mined it, not Anchored Sand. But there was gravel that was taken out before we did. We didn't really mine out of that area. That Anchored Sand didn't, because we'd already extracted everything they owned. But it was mostly railroad property, and so we owned what we were on, but there was railroad property in behind us, and that's where the gravel pits were. And then we, you know, as a laborer, I worked for, you know, various different things. I worked in the block plant, and then I took over running the yard, so we were loading trucks. And at that point, the majority of the concrete blocks that were sold were just plain old 8-inch standard blocks,
great,
and they were used for housing foundations. And there's three block plants in Anchorage: Concrete Products, and Alaska Brick, and Anchored Sand. and the block market was a lot bigger. It was probably around 5 million blocks a year, and it's down way, I mean, it's a fifth of that now, and most of them are specialty blocks instead of foundation blocks. But
what drives that, do you think?
Well, it's the fact that the housing market isn't as big. They're not building near as many houses, but also poured walls have come into play, and so there's back in those days, I would say 90% of the houses were built with concrete block and a few poured walls. And
there was land to develop then, yeah. Whereas now it's sort of building on something that's existing.
Yeah. I mean, there's just not any big subdivisions being built. I mean, we were building Ocean View and part of Turnigan and Turnigan West and all that. Everything west of or south of Northern Lights was undeveloped pretty much. And so they were developing that out in the West Northern Lights area, so all that things, but we just have trucks. We had Anchored Sand had two regular block trucks, one we brought from Precon, which we used, and then there was a guy that had the trucks for hire. There were boom trucks also, and he had three trucks, and he worked for Alaska Brick Concrete Products and ourselves. And so at various different times, we'd have six block trucks working out of our yard. Plus, we had a bunch of semis hauling blocks to commercial jobs all over the state, down into Valdez, Wheat, and Kenai, and those areas. And, I mean, there really wasn't any blocks. That was before the block plant was down in Soldotna. So we were hauling blocks all over the state. So on a Friday afternoon, you'd have three or four semis loaded up headed south. And they'd be gone all weekend, come back and load them up again.
You'd said that, I guess I was thinking about when you talk about being in Kodiak and having trouble getting permitting, how much different was that process back then than it is now?
I have no idea in the process, in the permitting process. I know this had to do with the fact of what I do know about that permit was that it had to do with the Corps of Engineers and stability of the ground more so than a normal building permit. And I doubt that Kodiak had any really building permits at that time. They may not now, but yeah. At that point, it was more of a deal from the Corps of Engineers to make sure it was stable before they would allow people to be build on it.
And you worked pretty much, once you got in at Anchor Sand and Gravel, you were just there, right?
Yeah. I was about 5 years working as a laborer, and then I went into and took over the counter sales, working on the sales counter, and did that for about 6 years and made it through the pipeline and all those good times and had boom time, and then took over block sales and did that for almost 20 years.
Really?
And then took over as sales manager after we were bought by
Forever.
Yeah.
And then at what point did you get involved with AGC in that process?
Well, there was different levels of AGC at that point. I remember back in the day, what really introduced me to AGC was back in the days of the convention, they had hospitality suites down at the Captain Cook, and these were just big parties. I mean, yeah. All the suppliers and, I mean, guys like Caterpillar and all the insurance companies and everything just set up suites throughout the hotel. So there was it started like on Tuesday and ran through, through Thursday.
Where'd those times go, man? And
so it was pretty much a big party, but that's where I got to know about AGC. And Herb at that point was pretty much the designated person with AGC. And I really didn't get involved in until I was the sales manager. I mean, we would do some things, and there's some projects and everything we'd get going, but truly, I didn't get active as a individual until I took over as sales manager.
Yeah. And is that when you met Stan from SBS?
Well, I'd known Stan before that, but not much before it. My story is that I called him up and said, "You're sales manager, Spinard, and I'm Spinard. I'm Anchored Sand sales manager, and we probably need to meet, at least talk to each other." I knew his name and I'd seen him, but I don't think he knew that I was had taken over that position.
Mm-hmm.
So we went out and had lunch and found out that we were duck hunters and fishermen, and we were best buddies from that day on. And we truly was a love at first sight type of thing, because we were very good friends after that.
Kind of, it's interesting, like I said, I came on when you retired, but that relationship still sort of defined AS&G and SBS to this day. Like, you know, there are still things that you two put in place, you know, that are, even though we're all owned by corporations, and now that the people who work there are still sort of interacting, you know, like in terms of employee discounts and stuff like that. Like, all of that probably came out of that, you know.
Well, we were good friends, but we were a close working relationship too. And so we could do things, and even though sometimes they went different ways than what I would have liked to have done, but there was opportunities for them and for us to do stuff. And there were certain things that we really didn't want to get into that was better that they handled, that made more sense. And I mean, one of them was fireplaces. And they went from, I mean, in the early days, all fireplaces were masonry, and they were built by the masons. And then they got to these zero clearance fireplaces, and they were put in by the carpenters. And so the carpenters didn't like, and usually didn't have accounts with Anchored Sand, so it was hard for them to buy. And so Spinard was buying a lot of fireplaces from us, and other people were. And so it turned out that it was better that they sold fireplaces. And it took up a lot of warehouse space for us, too. And at that point, it was kind of at a premium. So, and eventually, I don't know that we really wanted to give it up, but they were a much better fit for selling them because of the installers. And so we kind of got out of the zero clearance fireplace and stayed with the masonry stuff.
They're an interesting company up here in that each one of their footprints is specific to an environment. Like the store they have in Homer is totally different than the store they have in Eagle River, you know, or when they had that store in Big Lake or whatever. They all catered to this specific community based on what they needed, you know. The other thing they do that I wondered if AS&G ever did that is they have that huge commercial sales, like Bush selling, where they'll package a bunch of stuff together and take it to a remote location. Was that ever something that AS&G looked at, or was it just something that they were set up to do because they had more?
We have sold a lot of Bush materials.
Yeah.
But there are certain things that are required. I mean, a lot of the Bush locations don't have foundations except for pilings.
Yeah.
And so you're not going to send blocks out. I mean, they're so heavy and so awkward to deal with, you don't get a lot of value out of sending blocks out to a place like that. And because of the building conditions, it's not really feasible. So, I mean, we've sold a lot of concrete and cement and stuff like that out to Bush locations. And you've got involved in it where we sell, pre-sack, concrete mixes and stuff to send out to Bush. But that's been pretty much the extent of it. One of our stories was probably good to tell about because it made national news, but one town wanted 1,000 sandbags. And so we called, and the guy that was working the sales counter at that time, and it wasn't me, said, okay, you want 1,000 sandbags, and we want them shipped out to Dillingham, I believe it was, or one of the small villages. And all the conversation went, and he explained the cost and everything like that, and put them on an airplane and sent them out. And as it turned out, they wanted empty sandbags, and we sent full sandbags. So, I mean, the air bill was thousands of dollars to get 1,000 sandbags into this place, and wherever it was had all the sand they needed.
They just needed
the bags. And so there was a little bit of confusion, and so there was a lot of confirmation done after that time of what you were ordering and what you weren't doing. And but over the years, we've shipped a lot of stuff to the Bush, I mean, down for various different projects, and shipped them down the river and down the Yukon River and flown them out and done things like that. It just depends on the circumstances.
I spend a lot of time coordinating those with Super Sexy Concrete even now. And that same mistake you were talking about has been remade. This time it was made with multi-purpose sand when they wanted multi-purpose concrete mix. You know, I think it was to the tune of 7 or 8 pallets on an airplane. I think nowadays that mistake costs about $28,000. I don't know what it cost back then.
The logistics sometimes of shipping to the Bush was pretty tough back in then, because there was barges that went down the Yukon maybe two or three times a year, or shipped out of here and went around to the coast. I mean, we shipped stuff to Nome, but it had to go all the way around the Aleutians and on up. But there was only one or two barges a year that you could get it on, so you had to make sure you were right the first time, and we started checking pretty close after that deal. So.
What do you see as some of the ways that doing business, especially construction business, in our state has changed since the time you started to the time that you know?
Now, I would say that actually one of the major changes is just the way we communicate. Back in the day, I mean, it was, if you wanted to place an order for concrete, you, before you went to work in the morning, you'd stop somewhere or call in and place an order. And maybe at noon you went somewhere, found a phone booth, and called in to check the check and see if you were still on line to get concrete at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And that was it.
Yeah.
Now everybody on the job's got a cell phone. You get, our dispatcher in those days would maybe have 30, 40 phone calls a day. Now he's getting maybe 300 phone calls a day, because everybody on the job's calling every 20 minutes to see if the concrete's coming or when it's coming or changing. So communications, I mean, even as a salesman, we didn't know where our customers would necessarily be. So you were out driving around trying to find them. You're looking for
people. Yeah, because you can't call and check.
You
yeah.
couldn't call and see where they were. So you had an idea where they worked yesterday if we shipped material there. But then you truly had to run around and find your customers. You know,
down.
If you didn't, I mean, not having any way to get hold of them was probably the biggest thing. And just the way, I mean, shipping systems, and I mean, are pretty much the same. Concrete truck's a concrete truck. A block truck's a block truck. So, I mean, those have changed very little. But I think some of the ways they build the houses are different. And some of the ways that they were with the permitting processes, I mean, they weren't quite as elaborate then as they are now. So, I mean, you could go out and start a foundation and pour the footings and get the block and grout it all in one day, where now it's going to take you 2 or 3 days to get it because of inspections and everything like that. I'm not saying that's bad,
but it's just different.
But it's different.
I find that the relationship people have to what they want and when they want it from you is so much compressed now. You know, like I'll get a call from someone at 2 o'clock in the afternoon that wants me to bid something, and by the end of the day is fine. You know, like it bids tomorrow morning. I just need that by the end of the day. I'm thinking 2 o'clock, and all you've done is send me the other thing that I get now, that Earl was telling me was not something that he had to deal with when he was still working, when he started, was that people now, they just email you a PDF of the entire plans, and they go, read through this, figure out what it is that I need, and then bid it. You know, it's not like they call me up and they go, I need a bid for 40 yards of Class A concrete with this amount of air and this slump, and it needs to be in super sex. Those days are gone. Now it's just, here, you read through this. You accept the liability of giving it to me, you know. It's like there's this whole shared liability that doesn't exist anymore, you know.
Well, when I was working on the counter, I was, you know, because block deliveries were different, but they would call in many times and just give me the dimensions and say, okay, it's a 5-course foundation, you know, 20 by 40, you know, and I'd figure it out and send it to them. 99% of the time I was right.
Yeah.
You know, but there was always, I mean, always a few extra block here and there, so it wasn't a big deal. But the way they ordered was different than the way they do it now. And I don't think we even accept that liability for a block order anymore. But the customers were, I mean, we had basically the same guys doing everything all at the same time. And again, they were house foundations. They were fairly simple. It really wasn't a big deal. And, you know, the other part that we have is directions. I mean, the best one I can tell you is Eagle River, going up Eagle River Road, there was a big yellow rock.
I remember those, yeah.
And the yellow rock was based on, I mean, how far you went past that or where you turned.
It was like had a smiley face on it. Was it a red one?
It was just a yellow rock. I mean, they put all kinds of decorations on it. But a lot of the things were go to the streets didn't have names yet. I mean, so it'd be go to the yellow rock, or it's two bridges past the the yellow tree or whatever, and a lot of them were landmarks instead of real actual directions.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, there wasn't any maps. Yeah. I mean, these places were, I mean, they were growing so fast that the valley was unbelievable how fast it was growing in those times. And we actually had a yard in the valley where we just stockpiled blocks and so the guys could pick them up instead of having to drive back and forth all the time.
Oh, you just had a
stockpile.
That's a good idea. No, I came here from Chicago, and I'd met a girl at Alyeska, and she lives in Eagle River, and she gave me directions to her house, and they called it Happy Rock, I think, or something like that. It was like it was yellow, and it had a smiley face on it, and she was like, drive up to Happy Rock, and in my mind, freshly off the plane from Chicago, like it was like I was going to the moon, you know, like going to Eagle River. I couldn't imagine a place more remote than that, you know.
Well, I mean, we in some of the areas, I mean, we built all of down, I mean, all the housing that's here in Eagle River. Eagle River was pretty much just a wide spot in the road when we started sending block up in that area. And the valley was the same way. There was hardly anything back in there. So you go in, it was kind of encouraging to go in. You'd see a whole subdivision be built or a whole building be built. And that's the good part of construction is that you're done. You see this one, okay, let's start another project and go from there.
I remember that,
But I would say that the way we I mean, even though the vehicles of delivery are the same, how we did it was completely different because of no maps and no communication and stuff like that. So a lot of it was really hit and miss. And guys, the drivers we knew what the yellow rock meant and stuff like that. And, it was a fun time. So it was definitely a little wilder.
I mean, I've heard that from people before. Yeah.
I mean, as a salesman, I mean, a lot of the masonry contractors, if you didn't have beer on the job, they weren't working. I mean, you couldn't get away with that today. The housing guys might still, but there was a whole different level of alcohol flowing around in this town at that time. So,
yeah, I've heard a lot of those stories. I love that idea. I like being it, you know, things are so much different now, but I like the idea of it being more of the Wild West up here at the beginning, you know. Earl was telling me a story, Earl Poland, that when he would go out to visit his customers, he said, first off, you dress differently. My office was Harvey Doherty's office, or I have his job, or whatever. And he told me Harvey had a thing that before he went out, he'd stick his shoes in it, and it would shine his shoes before he went. I'm like, I can't imagine wearing shoes that you had to shine to, like, especially back then, but, you know, like, even now to a construction job, you know.
Well, Harvey was a little bit different because he was only peddling cement to the vendors, you know, or to the other companies. And so it's a little bit different for him than, I mean, you get more involved in a lot of things that he probably never got involved in.
But, he had a good gig.
But we had, I mean, the areas of construction and how it was done, I mean, we were a union operation, still are, and had a lot of good people. But
now, because back then, when I first moved here, there was a big sort of controversy between union and non-union. And I remember, like, you'd see, even in Illinois, where I was from, where there was a lot of graffiti, there was, like, non-union graffiti and union graffiti on things, you know. So it seemed like in the early 80s when I got up here, that was a contentious, I guess, arrangement. Was it Herb that decided to be union, or was it?
Well, I think we were union probably before Herb even bought the company. And as long as I know, we've been union.
Do you remember what year Herb bought the company?
It was right after numbers. The earthquake. He bought the and I'm having a tough time remembering the original owners, but he bought it after the earthquake. And the story I had is that there was so much damage to, like, all the concrete block and the batch plant. And I've seen pictures of the batch plant where it had collapsed and the blocks were just a pile of rubble. And these people didn't have the money to reconstruct. And if I got the story right, this Herb went in and he wanted to buy a piece of property, and they said, well, he can buy the whole damn thing for a little bit more than that, and so he did. Herb and his partners took it over at that time. Basically,
what was his partner? It was Bob Ballou?
No, Lou Dickinson.
Lou Dickinson, that's
was
right.
Was one of the partners, and it was Mike, and he had a brother that Herb had gone to school with here in Alaska, and well, I can't remember his last name too, but he was from New York, and I think he was actually the money man,
mm-hmm.
Mike Gellert, and Hugh Gellert was the Anchorage guy, but Mike was doing fairly well in New York and had the money to invest, and so he came in, and Herb was always the managing partner and ran the operation, and the other guys had their other jobs and did what they were doing, but I'm sure they had meetings every once in a while to discuss stuff, but Herb was probably much the man as far as running the place.
So I know one of the things I wanted to ask you, I didn't know this when I came up here, but I've always felt that in Alaska, if you're willing to kind of show up on time and work hard, you can kind of not just find a job, but you can kind of find a career that you can raise a family on, you know, which I didn't know this at the time, but that's not the case everywhere in the world. Like my friends back in Illinois or Jen's brothers and stuff back in Mississippi, like you could be the hardest working guy in the world, but there's just aren't any jobs in some places. You know, they end up being waiters or whatever. And I imagine when you were younger, it was probably even more so. But there seems to be, well, it seems like sort of the way people work now is different, and what people kind of, even in my generation, when we were starting, you know, and it may just be age. It may not be that this generation is any different than the other generation. It may just be that young people have different priorities, and it may not be that their job is their top priority starting at work. But I was wondering specifically about what advice you would be giving to people that are considering the construction industry, you know, now compared to then or whatever.
Well, I think, I've hired a lot of people over the years, and how you show up to a job is very, or for an interview, is mm-hmm. very important. And I've actually thought that this would be a good thing for me to do, is if I wanted something to do, is go talk to some of the schools and give them a tip of, you don't show up for a salesman's job and, you know, ratty t-shirt and, you know, just, you know, you prepare. First of all, I would say that most people trying to get into the industry should find out where they're going to work and what they're trying to do
mm-hmm.
before they walk in the door, you know, and find out if it's a job you really want, for one thing. But when I started, like I said, you know, get a haircut and, you know, if you want to work here, that's what it was. And they respected hard work. And there wasn't a lot of guff. And the labor foreman in that days was basically, I tell people that his leadership style was volume. You know, the louder you yell, the better you're going to do. And if you wanted to work there, fine. I mean, there was other work. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did look for other jobs and had found other jobs and had, you know, on my own looking, and if you wanted to work, you could work. But I liked Anchored Sand, and it was a good job. It was good paying, you know, the whole time I was there. And so it was easier to stay than it was to leave.
You know, yeah, and that was something that struck me about AS&G when I was interviewing, was that they sat me in a room, and everybody had to introduce themselves and say how long they'd worked there. And Earl was one of those guys, you know.
Yeah.
And he said, I mean, at that point, I think it was 39 years or 40 years, I don't know what it was back in 2008, but I just remember thinking that if this company has retained so many people, there must be a reason for that. And that, and when I was being driven around to look at all the different things AS&G does, Wes Vandermarten at the end of it goes, well, you know, that's what we do. He goes, talk to your family and, you know, make sure this will work for them, because, you know, it's important that what you do here, that fits into it. But that sentence, I was interviewing for a couple other jobs at the same time. No one said that to me. No one else was interviewing me going, hey, I hope that your family likes that you're working here. You know, no one, they could care less that even existed. So, yeah, those are some of the things that swung me to AS&G.
Well, I mean, it's been a great place to work. I really enjoyed working there. I mean, it's like, say, if you don't think it's work, you know, you're going there and you meet people, and of course there was good times and bad times, but out of 38 years I did work there, it was 99% good times. And,
yeah,
that was a big deal. And I enjoyed it, but I mean, like you said, when you started, it's how much you put into the job. And I would say that there is some difference in what I've seen in generations, and they don't really want to have a job for 38 years. They want to do something for a little bit and then try something new and different and experiment. And the technology is so much different that, you know, that there's different ways you can transfer within industries and be doing the same things. Whereas I started, it was all labor, you know, that's where you start. And then you get to a sales job and it's, you know, different ways of doing sales, you know, but it's mostly still heart and dedication. I mean, if you put your head and soul to it, you can do a good job.
I had a couple questions for you about that. You were talking about interviewing people to work for you. Of the people that were coming to interview, was working construction or that job, was it like, I want to do this, or was it more of a, I need a job and this is a job I can get? You know, I guess the reason I'm asking is because I've been talking to people about, you know, they're thinking that at age, is it fifth grade or something, people are either turning out of the trades or into the trades. And so how many of the people that came to you were people that wanted to be in the trades, or it was just a fallback because something else didn't work out, do you think?
Well, there's two different types of people that have come in. There's definitely people who knew what anchored sand were. We've hired a couple of people that were customers for anchored sand and wanted to do something different, and we've hired them, and they have been very successful, I mean, in working there. There's others that have come in because it's a job, and this one might be something they can get.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those have made it, some of them haven't. And different people fit different things, but we do have a very good record of long-time employees.
I mean,
the ones that are still there now, there's some new generations coming in some places, but the sales guys are all the same. The mixer drivers are all brand new since I've left. Some of the union guys down in the plants are still the same guys. But, you know, so you have different levels of what they're going to do. Some guys get into the union and they want to stay in the union because they have great benefits and great retirement, medical pensions. And I always said, you know, the best thing about unions is you can start off being a ditch digger and eventually own the company because you've worked your way up.
At what point did you move out of the union then? Was it when you went to the warehouse?
Well, it was an opportunity to go into sales.
No, I mean, so that's when you left the operators? Or not the operators, the laborers. Yeah. And how long were you in the union?
About 6 years, five or 6 years.
Yeah.
And it was an easy decision for me because, you know, I had something I wanted to do. And I'd been a salesman for other places and thought that, well, that's kind of what I wanted to do. And it was just the right time for me to do that.
Let me ask you a question about that, since you hired salesmen for a while. This is the first sales job I had, and I think the reason I got it was because Dave wanted someone in cement with a technical background in concrete. But I wasn't familiar with sales at all. And then what I was totally unprepared for was that the minute I took a job in sales, especially because of a technical background, it seemed like that technical background was immediately discounted because I was in sales. You know, the idea was you don't know, you know, kind of, or you're always proving that you're not just a salesman. So when you were hiring salesmen, what makes a good one?
Well, I think that there are salespeople are salespeople, and maybe a technical guy, and that may not be the right word, is a technical guy. And sometimes they mix and sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
I mean, some people will never be a salesman and others will never be a technical person.
But at the same time, we've all brushed up against that salesman that you're just like, oh God, get that guy out of my office.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think that there's, I mean, as with anything, there's good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, I mean, I know a lot of guys that's, like you said, that you just don't really want to deal with. It's more of a personality deal than what they know. I mean, I've talked to some very intelligent guys that are great in what they know, but don't know how to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
And so their presentation is so bad that you, like, get out of here. You know?
Yeah, or they know a bunch, but what they're not doing is using that knowledge then to benefit their customer.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, as a block salesman, I worked with masons to, and one of the best ones I can say is like Matsu Community College. They were up there and they have this one area where it's a big round building, and the mason was cutting the block. He had to cut every block to make this round deal, just taper the ends on. I said, well, we can do that. So I came back to the block plant, got with the guy that was running the plant, and he cut up a mold, and we made one just like he did it, and he never had to cut another block. Working with architects and getting them to, you know, different samples and different things and helping, well, here's what I really want it to look like. What can you do to get there? And we'd come up with different textures on blocks and different things, and some of them were new innovations, and some of them were just stuff we hadn't ever had before. And so it was kind of fun. I mean, I enjoyed the artistic side of sales and then the mechanical side of sales, because you could help something. I mean, if you can help an architect solve his problem of getting the right textures and things, colors or whatever he wants to do, that's great. But if you can help a mason where he's increases his production by a ton,
mm-hmm.
then you've really accomplished something. And these guys will remember that. I think I earned a great deal of respect among the masons in those days because I thought like they did. I could lay block. I didn't like it. But I'd go out there and sometimes I'd take lunch out to a crew, and while they were eating lunch, I'd lay a few blocks, and they usually didn't have to replace them, so it was okay, but I was not fast and didn't want to be. And so it was kind of fun, but I kind of had an idea what they were doing and how it worked. So it was good for them and good for me. And I think that created respect. And I think as a salesman, if you don't have that respect from your customers, whoever it may be, from the union journeyman to the architect, they're not going to call you.
Yeah.
You know, they want help. And they need, that's all your salesman is, a helper. He's just trying to help you solve your problems. So,
yeah,
that's what I tried to be.
Yeah.
Not a salesman, but if I could solve your problem, then they bought from me.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you're right. But I do tend to brush up against people that are just sort of more focused on how the customer can buy things in a way that's going to be easier for you to sell it to them, yeah. to a certain extent, you know. And I look a lot at, or I tend to feel that what I'm doing with a lot of customers is I'm just trying to shepherd them through AS&G's process or ABI's process so that it's not burdensome for them, so that it's easier for them to pay, so that they get things faster, so that they can sort of expedite their process and they don't have to spend a lot of time focusing on what we need, you know, more classic account management stuff, you know.
Well, I mean, we go back to what's changed in construction. Well, the change at Anchored Sand since when I started selling as to when I left selling was, I mean, we were all handwritten invoices, all handwritten quotes. We didn't even have a fax machine.
Yeah.
We had a teletype machine that only purchasing used. So you handwrote every quote that you did and delivered it to your customer.
Yeah, Earl was telling me he had his own secretary.
Yeah.
I mean, in being of the generation I'm of, the idea that someone else would type something up for you is just so beyond me. You
type
know?
Up the quotes, but I mean, literally, I mean, many quotes were written on bar napkins, and you bring them back to translate them the next day or whatever and have them in the file. Whereas now, as everything's computerized, you can basically do it on your phone
mm-hmm.
and put your quote into the system, and, you know, everything's good. I mean,
then, which system do you think was better?
Well, I think that you're talking front end or back end. Getting the information to the customer is slower now than it was before.
Yeah.
Getting it to the back end where it's accurate and actually gets the customer actually gets charged what you told you would is probably better now. I could write invoices on the counter, and I mean, I was the only guy on the counter.
Mm-hmm.
We have two or three guys on the counter now, and I was writing more invoices than they do now by myself. I was delivering. We have two block trucks now, and like I said, we had five or six plus the semis hauling. and I was doing that all by myself.
Yeah, but like you and Stan could get together at a bar and come up with an idea and implement it the next day.
Yeah.
But that could never happen.
No.
You know, like it could never happen anymore.
And I mean, like I say, I could shorthand my invoices, and as long as I went back at the end of the day and put the right codes in, everything was good.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so it was faster. I could be talking on the telephone to write a guy an invoice, and he'd be out the door before, you know, anybody even knew that anything was happening.
Yeah.
Where now you got to be on a computer and get it all punched in and everything accurate before it goes. And, guy go out in the yard, get his stuff, and then come and get the invoice. You know, it's just a whole different process.
Yeah, that never happened.
And I mean, I am sure that stuff got out the door before that is not getting out the door today.
Oh yeah, for sure.
But it was for the customer, it was probably a lot faster and a lot easier, but not near as accurate.
No, and I still brush up against those kind of old timer customers that come in and they're like, when you know it used to be this, why can't this just happen anymore? And there is no flexibility for a lot of those kind of things anymore. I'm sure it has negative, you know, associations with it. Also has some positive ones as well. But
well, they
it's
were
just a different world in that way.
Nobody really monitored this is quite as much as they do now. I mean, I'd go out and sell something and guy'd say, I'll give you the check, and I'd go out and deliver the block and then pick up the check on Friday and just hold the invoice until we gave me the check, you know, and I'd hound him until I got it.
But do you think that Ben Simmons will ever listen to this and his head will explode at that sentence right there?
Ben knew it. That's why he changed all the systems to counteract me. You know? I think between Chuck Warren and myself, we were probably a headache to him as far as his accounting and the way it should be done. And when we were bought by Knife River, no way in the world would they allow any of the stuff that we used to do, and it changed.
Yeah, I've seen our state change in that respect, in that, like, you know, like I worked for a guy who owned a ready mix company, and now that company got sold, and it's part of the Kolaska family now. But, you know, I've seen that process happen to a lot of these, you know, like Earth Movers and Fairbanks, and all of these icons of construction. In Fairbanks, when I was just coming into the industry, you know, now they're owned by these multinational corporations, or, you know, to a certain extent, just national corporations or whatever. And I've seen the industry change, and I've walked through it now, and I see a lot of positives in the way that costs are accounted for, and you know what you're spending it monthly. I remember we didn't know if we made money until the winter, and we'd work all summer, and then we'd go, oh, Jesus, we made a lot, or Jesus, we didn't. Like I can remember those days, and all, that's gone. But you know, at the same time, I've told this story before. Like I was crushing, I was doing the quality control on a crusher, and it was making D1, and needed a certain amount of D1, and it needed to be done by the end of the year. And it was getting late; it was fall, but it was warm, and we had enough D1. And I remember thinking, well, we should just keep making D1 because we know we're going to sell that eventually, right? And they said, no, we're going to take this plant down and ship it back. I think it came back to Anchorage, and then we'll ship it back up in the spring and start making it again. And I mean, it blew my mind that we would, like, what do you mean? We're in spec. We'll just make it now. And it wasn't until I started working at ASNG, I was telling Dale that story, and Dale said, well, yeah, actually, there's a huge difference between a corporate or, you know, a shareholder corporation that has to answer to shareholders and be profitable quarterly than, you know, just a guy who owns a company is trying to avoid tax liability and make things as cheap as possible. So they probably shut that crusher down and moved it out so they didn't have to pay for it for a quarter. Yeah. And it didn't matter that it cost money to ship it down, it cost money to ship it back. Your responsibility is to your shareholders, not to an owner. And yeah, it's just a different mindset, you know. Oh, so let's talk about this real quick. We're going to go forward and do some of these interviews, you and me. What are your goals for this? What do you hope to get out of this?
Well, I think that as I get older, there's less people know how it happened and what they were doing.
I totally agree.
You know, there is a history, and I personally am a history buff and like to know how things were done and how we got to where we are. And so it's interesting to me to be able to hear other people share their stories and for me to share mine,
mm-hmm.
as to someday, 50 years from now, somebody say, who? But that was a hell of a story.
Yeah.
Boy, that was interesting. I mean, who can believe that they didn't have cell phones or didn't, you know, that we had to get up in the morning and make sure you knew where every, you know, phone booth in town
was. Have a bucket full of quarters.
You know, and go out there and be able to and call in and tell people stuff. And that was the only way you got hold of them. So people, I mean, we look back and I look back at what my parents did and no TV and you know, they're barely radios at some time and how they lived and, you know, what we do today. And it's just incredible what the changes are. And like you said, to start with, I mean, 50 years from the time of basically the earthquake, when it really started going, that was, and the oil booms and the things that have come along since then. I mean, the state has grown tremendously. You know,
I remember you and I going to lunch and you were telling me that Anchorage basically ended at Northern Lights, you know.
Yeah.
And I got up here in 85, I think. And so just the idea that all of that was just the woods, you know. It's hard for me to wrap my head around, you know.
Well, you had basically Arctic Boulevard went out to International Airport. C Street, I don't think, went through at that point. And then you had the old Seward Highway.
See, I can remember when Minnesota didn't go through. I remember when that got punched to that.
Well, Minnesota didn't go any farther than Tudor.
Oh, no, I meant it ended at Dino.
No, Minnesota ended at Tudor. You went up through a little housing subdivision. Spinard was there.
Mm-hmm.
And you went up and there was...
my favorite road in Anchorage. Yeah. I live on the end of it now.
Yeah. And so you went up there and you went up. It was 44th Avenue. It wasn't Tudor at that point. And then you went up and you got into Arctic, and that was how you got out to International. And like I said, I don't remember C Street going through, but it may have. And so it really dead ended. I mean, you were a whole different area out there. And I had a lot of friends that lived in Sand Lake, and there was some development out there already. And so you could get out there, but a lot of the roads were dirt.
and that was the pit. That was one of the pits out there.
Oh, yeah.
I remember when I was in high school, we'd go out there and drink.
Yeah.
I didn't know. I had no idea what I was looking at back then. But, it was just a place to hide from
but
people.
But there was the gravel, and we mined on both sides of Sand Lake Road.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we just filled in one of the other pits that we've done. One's turned into we filled in one. They built a housing project in another. We filled in another pit, and there's one more left that nothing's been happened to it, and I imagine it'll be our next dump site,
at
whatever. But I mean, those were all dirt roads. You know, Northern Lights was dirt after Lake Otis. You know.
Really?
Yeah, and then Lake Otis was a four-way stop.
Oh, going towards Muldoon, you're talking.
Going towards Muldoon.
Okay, I'll buy that. Sure.
And
Lake Otis was a four-way stop.
You had, you could duck hunt where Walmart is now off of A Street. A Street, Benson wasn't there. That was it. And I learned to drive out off of Northern Lights. There was Wendy's Lake out there. And my dad just turned me loose on the lake and said, tell me when you can make it around in a circle without spinning out. And that's how I learned to drive.
The changes that this town has seen over that, I mean, just in the period that I've been here, it's been pretty phenomenal. So,
I mean, I lived up after my first house was across from Service High School, and we used to snow machine out of our houses, go up in the mountains up in Chugach, and just take off.
That doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
That still happened in Fairbanks a bit. One morning, early morning in Fairbanks, it snowed all night when I was in college, and I was staying with, I think I might have been with Jen, actually. I might have been out of college. I was in her house, which was on like 4th Avenue in Fairbanks, and I see what I think is a motorcycle coming up in a blizzard, but it's not. It's a dog team. It had come up the river, turned into town just because they could, because it came right up. Was it 2nd Avenue? I forget where Jen's house was. Yeah, it was insane.
But, I mean, things that, the dog sleds weren't, I mean, they were all just, there really wasn't any, you know, people doing it for business or anything, but there was people who were still racing and stuff like that. But there was dog farms all over town. I mean, we're right there at 36 was a big dog farm just at that point, 36 in Seward Highway.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I was at Geneva Woods. Mm-hmm. And that was a big dog farm. They were all over. I mean, there was a lot of dog farms around, but one for racing,
yeah,
and stuff like that.
Fairbanks is still kind of that way.
Or recreational.
Yeah.
But snow machines in town, that was no big deal. Hunt, I mean, you could hunt right out at the International Airport. My little brother came home with a moose on his front of his car before school one day. there wasn't as many people, so you did stuff. You know, it's just was pretty much wide open.
Did I tell you about my first girlfriend when I moved up here? Lived out off of Golden View, which is still way the hell out there. Then yeah. You know, the road kind of ended at her house, and I had taken her home, and she had to be in at whatever time it was, 10 o'clock. I can't remember. And we did what every teenager did. This is before cell phones. We made plans that I'd come back in a half hour and I'd pick her up. And I went up to her, tap, tap, tap on her window. And she's a basement window, you know. And she starts coming out. And I look over. I mean, and I have been in Alaska for a month or two. Like, not long. And I see these three dogs eating garbage out of a garbage can. I thought, oh, that's weird. And then I look back and I notice one of those dogs stood up on its hind legs, you know. And maybe being a kid from the city, like, I just freaked out. And what I did was I just left. She's half in the window, half out. I ran. I got in my truck and I took off, you know. And then I very sheepishly called her the next morning because you couldn't call in the middle of the night, you know, like just to make sure she survived or whatever. But she didn't break up with me. She had every right to. She's still one of my best friends, you know, like we're still tight today. Me and her whole family, you know.
Yeah, we used to be able to, our spring trip was, I had a bunch of friends that had Jeeps and trucks, four-wheel drive, and we could go up off of Golden View, and we'd go through what's the pipeline pass now,
mm-hmm.
and you could drive your Jeeps over there and come out in Indian.
Really?
Yeah, and that was our early spring trip, because the creeks weren't too high, and you'd go through the creeks and everything like that, but that was always fun.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'll tell you what, one of the things I'm looking forward to this is, like, for you, you kind of know all these people, and it'll be a great chance to kind of reconnect with all of them, you know, but for me, like, they're guys that I don't really interact with, you know, so it's a good chance to meet a lot of these people and hear their stories. I'm really looking forward to that. And also, I'm like you, I recognize, and this point was really driven home after Earl died, that, you know, all that information just left with him, you know, like, and I took that for granted, having an office next to him, that whenever I wanted to know about what used to be there or what this was before it became this building, or, you know, I just stop in and I just yell over the wall to him and he could answer those questions, you know?
Yep. And a lot of them are leaving now. I mean, there's, mm-hmm. as we get older and older, there's more that go that know that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, we kind of made up a list, and a lot of those guys are older than me and have information that nobody else has, you know, and it's like, say, once they're gone, it's gone. You
yeah.
know, and it's, so.
Or even if they're just retiring and moving out yeah. of state, you know. So, yeah, it's a whole lot it's a resource. I'd like to at least get to talk to a little bit and figure out how to coax out their best stories, you know, because
sure. there's a lot of stories yeah. I could tell that would never make it on on public line.
Well, yeah, that was why we said we'd edit these out. If people wanted them to not say something, or they wanted us not to publish the whole thing after we did it, we could definitely do that. Well, yeah, this is a good enough place to end.
Yeah, we can stop here, and if we want to add more, we can add more.
And we'll see if I can figure out a way to
see if it actually records.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
Thank you for listening to the Alaska Works Podcast, brought to you by a generous contribution from the Construction Industry Progress Fund and the Associated General Contractors of Alaska.